That. Elizabeth is a medical epidemiologist at the LA County Department of Health. She's a graduate of the CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service Program and is board certified in preventive medicine. She currently specializes in infectious diseases and disability epidemiology, and she'll talk to us about the challenges facing epidemiologists at local health department as emphasis changes from infectious diseases to chronic diseases. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bancroft.
Very loud. I use a wheelchair, so I can't stand behind this podium. And I just did something very bad, but I changed it, made it better. So I'm going to try to use a big booming voice that I have from all my years as a New Yorker. Hopefully you'll be able to hear me without the microphone. For folks who are over there, I can't see you. I have no idea if you can see me, but if you can't hear me, at some point you're going to have to move over and wave your hand, and then I'll speak louder. So, the future of epidemiology, wither local health departments. And I bring this up because when I was asked to speak on this panel, I was told that some people think the future of epidemiology is dead. And actually, then I started doing a little literature search because for me, epidemiology is alive and well. I use it every day. I'm a physician, but I consider myself a medical epidemiologist. I use epidemiology every single day in public health. And looking at the literature, though, it's a little depressing. Epidemiology has, quote, exhausted its potential and is dead. Epidemiology generates conflicting results, which confuses the public. That all the basic associations have been found, therefore, why do you need epidemiology? And that new tools and statistical methods are needed, like old odds ratios, risk ratios. They don't seem to be sexy or useful anymore, at least according to the literature. And I want to show you that epidemiology is alive and well, at least at local health departments, but we are going to have to make some changes for the future. But first, let me prove my point that the traditional methods and things like that are alive and well. But this is really, I think, what the literature is saying, that basically the kind of broad street pump epidemiology is dead, and the future is all mathematical models based on Greek letters. And that's where the future is going. And as I said, I want to show that the tools of the past, the kind of Broad Street pump tools, are still active in the present and the future. And these tools are as simple as case series, case control studies, population surveillance along with reportable diseases, the kind of bread and butter epidemiology we do every day in local health departments, and also cross-sectional studies of what we do of our populations. And I'm going to start off with a very basic case series, and I'm going to be a little parochial and use a lot of examples from Los Angeles County, really representing a local health department. And this is a reprint in 1996 of an MMWR that came out in 1981 about five young gay men with pneumocystis pneumonia and very low CD4 counts. First report. This came out in June of 1991, a simple, modest case series, one of the most basic tools we have of epidemiology. There's not even statistics. You only need one hand. You count one through five. Those are the number of patients. That's the most complicated statistics it got. But yet, from reports like this and many others that were starting to come in, epidemiologists at CDC and elsewhere were able to develop a case definition that was used worldwide. They were able to develop basic surveillance using active surveillance that established that this syndrome was new and that the number of cases was truly increasing. By 1983, epidemiologists knew that AIDS was caused by an agent that was transmitted through sexual contact and transmitted through blood. By 1983, they were able to make official recommendations that sexual contact should be avoided by persons with known or suspected to have AIDS, and they had a case definition that made it look, you know, you could start telling when people had an immune deficiency, and that persons at increased risk for AIDS should refrain from donating plasma or blood. Also, by 1983, work was already intensified on developing safer blood products for persons with hemophilia, since it was clear that persons with hemophilia were disproportionately affected. I'd like to point out the power of epidemiology. All of these recommendations, all of these things were known before there was a blood test for epidemiology and before it was even identified in the blood. So all of these public health actions were taken based on modest things like case series, case control studies, active surveillance. Recommendations could be made before a lab was even available and able to test the disease for HIV. In terms of case control studies, we use them quite regularly. Here's actually several case control studies that were done across the country, again, one in Los Angeles, looking at hepatitis B in nursing homes. And what we're finding is a lot of acute hepatitis B in nursing homes, and when we do case control studies, we see they're all occurring in diabetics, and not just diabetics, those who are receiving regular finger sticks within the nursing home, people who are receiving insulin, receiving regular finger sticks. And we're really showing that it's due to poor infection control practices when it comes to giving finger sticks to people in nursing homes. Because of all of these case control studies identifying this as a new risk factor for hepatitis B, because frankly, in the past, we always thought of hepatitis B as a sex, drugs, and rock and roll disease. That's pretty much how you got it. But now we're seeing these people who are 60, 70, 80, they're in skilled nursing facilities, not so much chance for sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They have to have something else. The case control studies are showing what it is, showing that it's coming from these poor infection control practices, and from there, new recommendations can be made, new standards can be made for how these simple things, a simple finger stick that's done every day, how it can be improved so that people aren't getting acute hepatitis B in their elder years while they're in nursing homes. Reportable diseases. Extremely important. I mean, this is some of the bread and butter of surveillance that we do in epidemiology, population trends, and it's still alive and well and important. And here's an example, again, from Los Angeles County, looking at invasive pneumococcal disease. These are incident rates by year of culture. And here we have, you know, seeing an incident rate pretty high. Prevnar, which is the new vaccine for pneumococcal disease for young children, that was introduced in 1999, and you can see the rates came down really nicely. What we are seeing, though, is an uptick in the most recent rates, and that's actually being seen across the country, and that's because we're starting to see some serotype replacement. The vaccine, there's about 90 to 100 serotypes of pneumococcal disease. The vaccine targets the 7 most prevalent types that cause disease. But what's happening now is by removing those serotypes, the other serotypes, you know, 80-some serotypes are getting a chance to come in. It's now an open playing field for them. They don't have competition from the most prevalent ones anymore, and they're starting to slowly increase the rate of pneumococcal disease. We wouldn't know this without basic reportable disease surveillance. Again, the bread and butter tools of epidemiology, alive and well and working in policy every single day and affecting our policies, affecting the fact that now a new vaccine is being developed to try to catch up on those particular serotypes that are starting to raise their little ugly heads. But beyond that, we can look at these trends in other very basic epidemiologic ways. Here, for example, is invasive pneumococcal disease throughout Los Angeles County, and these are our zip codes in Los Angeles County. And because our county is so large, we divide them into 8 different service planning areas, or SPAs. We are Southern California. We like our SPAs, after all. And you can see, though, if you look at where the most number of zip codes are, you can see they really come down. I'm hoping, here the cursor, sort of SPA 6. This SPA 6 area has the most number of these zip codes that have a high rate of pneumococcal disease. Well, this is important, and we couple this reportable disease work with some cross-sectional studies that we do in Los Angeles County. And these cross-sectional studies, we do them every couple of years, and we call 8,000 random digit dialed people home numbers, and we ask them about 25 minutes worth of questions that have to do with health, including questions such as percent of adults greater than 50 that are vaccinated for influenza in the past year, and percent of adults greater than 65 who ever received the pneumococcal vaccine. And what we're able to see by overlaying these two very simple kinds of epidemiologic data is that not only does SPA6 have the highest rate of invasive pneumococcal disease, but it has the lowest rate of ever receiving pneumococcal vaccine. It also has the lowest rate of receiving influenza vaccine, and from our simple, humble vital statistics data, death certificate data, we also see it has the highest rate of pneumonia and influenza deaths. So again, simple, humble epidemiology can tell us a lot about what's going on in a population and help direct our interventions. So you don't need a lot of, you don't need a full Greek alphabet to be able to make policy, make interventions, and make a difference in your community. And here's a cross-sectional surveillance. Again, what we do, this is tobacco use. I apologize. It's not your eyesight. This is a fuzzy slide here. But it's looking at tobacco use, again, in Los Angeles County amongst high school students. And what we found is that tobacco use from 1997 was up at around 26%, but now it's come down to 14%, and it seems to have stagnated at 14%. So again, basic cross-sectional tools, looking at environmental determinants of disease. Over 750 retailers in Los Angeles were studied, and we found that 40% of businesses illegally sold tobacco to children. So this is a problem. No wonder we can't stop high school students from smoking if there's going to be so many businesses that illegally sell it. And we found that the highest illegal sales rate in 2003, discount stores, 75% of them, no problem. If you're a high school student, you can get tobacco, even though the legal age is 18. So, what does that lead to California and Los Angeles County policy actions? It means that tobacco sellers must obtain a license, just like if you sell alcohol. You have to see it as a regulated product they're selling. There are now laws prohibiting the use of tobacco-related products near playgrounds or in any of the state parks in California. Let that be a lesson to you if you decide to leave the conference and go out to a state park. Don't bring your cigarettes with you. There's prohibited use in municipal beaches in Los Angeles County. So we have a pretty long beach line, and there's only a couple miles of state parks in those beach lines where you're allowed to smoke. Otherwise, completely prohibited in the beaches, which is where, again, a lot of teenagers hang out. And it's also given us more ability to do enhanced sting operations of all of these retailers that are illegally selling to younger kids. Again, your basic epidemiologic tools, really putting policy into action. But there are some considerations for our traditional epidemiology that we need to really look towards the future, because a lot of what I talked about were the infectious diseases, and that's where a lot of public health, local public health epidemiology has been focused on over the time period. And I'm really talking about local public health, your public health departments. Some of them are changing demographics and also changing disease trends. Changing demographics, looking at the aging of the population. If you look from 1960, where the baby boomers are, where they were in 1990, and then you look at 2020, where they are coming up. So we've got a changing and an aging population. We need to start really focusing a lot of our efforts on what causes disease in an aging population. Again, kind of getting back to those skilled nursing facilities and the hepatitis B, but just a lot of issues that go around an aging population. We need to look at changing causes of death. In 1900, you can see pneumonia, tuberculosis, diarrhea, top three causes of death, all infectious diseases. Now we look in 2005, our top three causes of death, really looking all diseases of heart, cancer, cerebrovascular diseases. These are not areas that we in local public health have traditionally focused on. Our reportable diseases, for example, have pretty much exclusively been infectious diseases. Our follow-ups, our case control studies, pretty much exclusively infectious diseases. So I think we do, as part of the future of epidemiology in local health departments, we need to improve our surveillance for non-infectious diseases. For example, New York City recently put high levels of hemoglobin A1C. If you have a high level, it's a marker of uncontrolled diabetes. They recently made that a reportable condition in New York City. So they can track and follow what their uncontrolled diabetes population is. And I think that's important because the data that I just showed you were causes of death. death is too late. We need to know about what people have before they die, because that's really where we need to intervene. The only thing that we can do for somebody after they're dead is make sure they have a nice funeral. You know, I want to do something earlier than that. So different places that local public health can consider in improving epidemiology at local public health. Consider making cholesterol greater than 300 reportable, for example. Then you start getting a sense of population surveillance of who is going to be at risk for some pretty bad cerebrovascular disease. You could consider making high troponin levels, also a marker of an MI, reportable, trying to get a sense of how many heart attacks are occurring within your county. New strokes on CT or MRI, you could make them just as reportable as you could Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter. If someone identifies a new stroke, not an old stroke, we know there's prevalence, but let's look at incidence of new strokes within our own jurisdiction. Why not work with the drug manufacturers or even force them into it to say how many new prescriptions for antidepressants are given in a jurisdiction in a time period? They know that from sales. They have it all nailed down. They know what their high counties, their low counties, they know how many new prescriptions are occurring in a county. Mental health is severely underlooked, and it is a disproportionate cause of disability in our populations. Why not be able to track that just as much as we do meningococcal disease, pneumococcal disease? Or work with our law enforcement partners, really looking at domestic violence complaints or domestic shelter admissions, for example, people who are going to shelters for domestic violence, because that's a public health problem that we don't routinely track. So I would suggest that we need to improve our surveillance and improve the epidemiology of non-infectious diseases. And there are some new challenges in infectious diseases that we need to look at for the epidemiology. Hospital-acquired infections are estimated to cause about 100,000 deaths of people in the United States every year. I want to contrast that with Salmonella, which is thought to cause about 700 deaths, 100,000 to 700 deaths. Yet Salmonella is routinely reportable. Most health departments have personnel who follow up on it. Most health departments don't have personnel that follow up with hospital-acquired infections. So it is becoming reportable in California and the United States. That's a first step. We're going to need to figure out what to do with those rates once they're reported, and how do we help hospitals bring those rates down. Antibiotic resistance, another new challenge in infectious diseases, may require more reporting. We also really have a new paradigm in infectious diseases. It used to be an infectious disease, you got it, and you either died or you got better. Most of the time, you got better. But now we have these chronic infectious diseases. We have HIV, we have hepatitis B, we have hepatitis C. We haven't really set up good epidemiology to follow up on our chronic infectious diseases, and I think this is a challenge for us. And then finally, the challenge of doing preparedness work and bioterrorism. Right now, again, all you really need are fingers and toes to do the epidemiology of bioterrorism, because there's only 17 cases of anthrax that occurred in 2001. So that's pretty much most people's fingers and toes. You really don't need that much sophisticated work. But in terms of preparedness and the epidemiology of something like a pandemic influenza, we're going to need to improve our epidemiology, improve our syndromic surveillance greatly if we're going to be able to follow a large-scale pandemic. And then as much as I say that bread and butter epidemiology is alive and well, I do think we need to improve some of our epidemiologic data and our methods and let them go in different directions. Different areas that I see with this would be decision analysis, cost utility analysis, evaluating interventions, disease modeling, and health impact assessments. I'm going to skip decision analysis and cost utility analysis. I'm going to focus just a little bit here on intervention evaluation, hand washing, for example. I mean, we do a lot of work on what makes people sick. We need to do better work on what makes people well, on how to prevent illness. So, for example, there was a recent article that came out in JAMA on the effect of intensive hand washing promotion on childhood diarrhea. I think this is an area that we need to go to look at just how effective are our interventions. If we put a lot of money into a campaign, for example, telling people, you know, use use insect repellent for West Nile virus, and we put a lot of money into that campaign. Is it making a difference or not? Are people actually using more insect repellent, and are they using enough insect repellent in order for them not to get bit by mosquitoes? We need to start evaluating our preventive actions that we're doing. And this was a very interesting study design. It was a randomized clinical trial. It was controlled throughout. And they did show a statistically significant improvement with intensive hand washing interventions, where the rate of diarrheal disease went down, showing that a public health measure could make, a prevention measure could make a difference in outcome. I think we need to start challenging ourselves to do more of that in the local public health department. New methods. As much as I poo-poo all the Greek letters, I think there is room for new methods at looking at transmission models, trying to understand better when and where to make interventions. They are the models with all the Greek letters. One of the things I will say about the models is that all the inputs are still based on basic descriptive epidemiology. For example, in the model that I just showed you, all of these Greek letters, they're all based on basic things like population size, birth rate, proportion of people who are susceptible to a given disease. That's all based on basic vital statistic, basic epidemiologic surveys. So you can have fancy models, but the fancy models are based on the basic bread and butter work that we do in epidemiology. So no matter how fancy you get, basic epidemiology is going to be a part of that. And finally, just very quickly, a health impact assessment. This is a new area. We looked at the problem of obesity. I know that my colleague here will spend some time on obesity. We saw it going up in Los Angeles County. And what they took a look at and did a sort of an extensive review using a lot of out-of-the-box creative look at just very simple estimates is if you did restaurant menu labeling, would that have any impact on the obesity epidemic? And they were able to estimate, okay, how many meals are served by restaurants that are come from large fast food chains, for example. Okay, what percent of people who actually would see a menu calorie, you know, count make a difference and decide to order less food? Okay, on average, how many calories does that translate to for Los Angeles County as a whole? How many calories are per pound? Okay, how many pounds might be averted by this? And they were able to go through all this. There's all these numbers there, but all these numbers are nothing more than simple addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. Nothing very complicated, but using numbers beyond our basic epidemiology to show that they think they can avert about a 39% of the gain that we would normally expect during this time period. It doesn't mean it just basically means we're slowing the obesity epidemic. People are still gaining weight, but it's nice to see some way of quantifying what public health action can do with something like menu labeling. This kind of assessment was extremely important. It went into Schwarzenegger's decision to this time sign the California law. He originally didn't sign it in 2006. To sign a 2008 California law passed requiring restaurant chains with more than 15 outlets to post calorie counts. It will take some time to see this effect on obesity, and then, even more important, take some time to see the effect on death rates, but I think it is an important first step, and it's based on local public health epidemiology, local data. So, conclusions. Epidemiology is alive and well in local health departments. We do need to expand its use into non-infectious diseases. We do need to study what makes people well, not just what makes them ill. And we do need to evaluate interventions to efficiently use our resources. And with that, thank you very much.
Thanks, Elizabeth, for a fantastic talk. I guess the hue and cry about epidemiology's demise is premature. So next I'd like to introduce